Good evening, and welcome to the Law, capitalized, and the Law, lowercase. It's a comparison of the American law and the Torah law, sponsored as always by Becky Navi Katz, Le'ili Nishmas Yonah ben Rabbi Leib. And as you just heard, I was zochah to become a grandfather today of another grandchild. Ari and Lauren had a daughter, Baruch Hashem. So the shir should be in her merit that she should have a long and productive and happy and spiritually fulfilled life with God's help. Tonight we're looking at the New York Times versus Sullivan and the law of defamation and how the Torah views not only libel but especially journalism. So there's no area of Torah life that's more challenging to the serious Jew than the prohibition of Lashon Hara, and none that is as prevalent or as difficult to withstand. The Gemara says in Baba Basra, Daf Kuf Samech Hei Amid Aleph, that Rov Begazel, most Jews stumble in the area of thievery, Umiut Barayos, and a minority in the area of immorality, Vakol B'Lashon Hara. Everybody in Lashon Hara, of course, says everybody, how could that be? The Lashon Hara Sakadaiko, Ella Avak Lashon Hara, at the very least, the dust of Lashon Hara, meaning if not actual Lashon Hara, which is disparaging information about another that causes the listener to have a lower opinion of the subject, that's Lashon Hara, then at least the dust of Lashon Hara, that indirect allusions to derogatory information that ultimately has the same effect. And yet, there's no Torah concept that clashes so directly with an American value as does Lashon Hara, especially as it's been interpreted by the U.S. Supreme Court. So, famously, we all know the First Amendment to the Constitution guarantees that, I quote, paraphrase, Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or of the press. What complicates it even more is that that freedom is lauded, even celebrated, and not only in the area of Lashon Hara, which although derogatory, at least has the advantage of being true, but especially when it comes to what we technically call Motzi Shemra, that is disparaging another with falsehoods. So, American law and jurisprudence are quite clear. In the struggle between the societal benefits of a free and vibrant press and the individual's right not to have his reputation besmirched and defamed, even falsely, the seminal 20th century case of press freedom put the court squarely on the side of society and against the individual. And that now we come to the Times versus Sullivan. So, like many of the notable cases of the last century, this one, the Times versus Sullivan, has race at its core. L.B. Sullivan was technically the police commissioner of Montgomery, Alabama. Now, Montgomery, not that you really care, but it was governed by three commissioners, and those commissioners divided the various departments among themselves, so Sullivan was nominally the police commissioner, since that was one of the departments under his control, and he was in charge at a time of very heated racial tensions, late 50s in Alabama. On March 29th, 1960, I was but a tot then. Nonetheless, in my crib was thrust this full-page advertisement from the New York Times that shocked me back then. The Times carried an ad that said as follows. I read it to you. As the whole world knows by now, thousands of Southern Negro students are engaged in widespread, nonviolent demonstrations in positive affirmation of the right to live in human dignity as guaranteed by the United States Constitution and the Bill of Rights. It went on to charge that, quote, in their efforts to uphold these guarantees, they are being met by an unprecedented wave of terror by those who would deny and negate that document, which the whole world looks upon as setting the pattern for modern freedom. The ad continued, we get to the crux of it, although wave of terror, of course, put a certain taint on it. In Montgomery, Alabama, after students sang, My Country Tis of Thee, on the state capitol steps, their leaders were expelled from school, and truckloads of police armed with shotguns and tear gas ringed the Alabama State College campus. When the entire student body protested to state authorities by refusing to re-register, their dining hall was padlocked in an attempt to starve them into submission. Again and again, the Southern violators have answered Dr. King's peaceful protests with intimidation and violence. They have bombed his home, almost killing his wife and child. They have assaulted his person. They have arrested him 7 times for speeding, loitering, and similar offenses. And now, this is what precipitated the ed, they have charged him with perjury, a felony under which they can imprison him for 10 years. That was, in sum and substance, the ed. It had dozens of people who signed on to it. It was put forward by the major Baptist preachers, black Southern Baptist preachers. Now, the decision, the Supreme Court decision, written by Justice William Brennan, New Jersey's own Brennan. We do much better with New Jersey's own Samuel Alito today, but that's besides the point. The decision admitted that most of what was written here was not true, in the end. I quote from the decision, "It is uncontroverted that some of the statements contained in the 2 paragraphs were not accurate descriptions of events which occurred in Montgomery." Although, all right, so now Brennan starts off. You think he started with the most powerful argument? It was as if he was like sticking it to Sullivan. "Although Negro students staged a demonstration on the state capitol steps, they sang the national anthem and not 'My Country 'Tis of Thee.'" Ed was wrong. "Although," but now we come to more substantive errors. "Although 9 students were expelled by the State Board of Education, this was not for leading the demonstration at the Capitol, but for demanding service at a lunch counter in the Montgomery County Courthouse on another day. Not the entire student body, but most of it had protested expulsion, not by refusing to register, but by boycotting classes on a single day. Virtually all the students did register for the ensuing semester." So that was also wrong. Now we come to the police action. "The campus dining hall was not padlocked on any occasion, and the only students who may have been barred from eating there were the few who had neither signed a pre-registration application nor requested temporary meal tickets." You know, the police kept out. People shouldn't have been there. "Although the police were deployed near the campus in large numbers on 3 occasions, they did not at any time ring the campus, and they would not call to the campus in connection with the demonstration on the state capitol steps, as the 3rd paragraph implied. Dr. King had not been arrested 7 times, but only 4. And although he claimed to have been assaulted some years earlier in connection with his arrest for loitering outside a courtroom, one of the officers who made the arrest denied that there was such an assault. Additionally, the statement, 'They have bombed his home, almost killing his wife and child,' was not at all attributable to the Montgomery Police Department. In fact, Sullivan himself was not even commissioner at the time King's house was bombed, nor was he even commissioner for 3 of the 4 arrests. So what's problematic here was that he had painted with a very broad brush, especially the repeated use of the word they. Start with the police, and then add they, the Southern violators, they, as if all the perpetrators were named. One thing that's fascinating about the ad was that Sullivan was not named. His name was not even in the ad, but under the law, then and now, if one is indirectly identified, that suffices for being potentially victimized under defamation law. So what Sullivan contended was that if there were repeated reference, or really a single reference, to the Montgomery Police Department, and then a string of statements beginning with the word they, he as commissioner was directly attacked by these statements. If those statements are false, they should be actionable. By the way, just to be clear on our definitions, defamation has 2 types. Slander is verbal defamation, and libel is written or printed defamation. Shouldn't get the 2 confused. I digress, but I'm often irritated by people who misused, robbed, and burglarized. A woman ate at my house this past Shabbos. informed me that her office was robbed. And I said, really, were you there? She said, no, not at all. So I said, thank God, you weren't robbed. You were burglarized. Small comfort. It irritates me, what can I tell you? So in fact, Sullivan sued an Alabama state court alleging that the advertisement libeled him by charging him with falsehoods, as if to say he, as commissioner, was responsible for a wave of terror, that was the statement used, in which police ring the campus with guns and tear gas, making arrests, preventing students from leaving or entering a dining hall, even bombing King's home. None of that was true. Sullivan sued the Times and also four ministers who were named in the ad, the most famous among them, Ralph Abernathy and Joseph Lowry, claiming not that he suffered financial harm, but that his reputation had been impugned. Sullivan went to court in Alabama. Guess what? He won. The court finding that the statements would tend to injure him in his public office, or impute misconduct to him in his office, which is what it did, or want of official integrity, or want of fidelity to public trust. Defendants were ordered to pay Sullivan $500,000. They appealed. The Alabama Supreme Court affirmed, and the case made its way to the real Supremes. In 1964, 4 years later, the case was decided, and the court reversed 9-0. Again, a shutout. Interestingly, long before this, I think just months after the ad was published, the Times had published a retraction of the ad insofar as it criticized the governor of Alabama, but they pointedly did not retract anything about Sullivan, arguing that they didn't think any of the language referred to Sullivan, because they never mentioned him. In the decision, the justices broke new ground, and Brennan was responsible for it. Ordinarily, in a libel case, the plaintiff has to show that the statements made by the defendant were false and defamatory. That is to say, they harmed his reputation, caused some damage. So therefore, for example, truth is always a defense in a libel case. Or a statement might be false, but not necessarily defamatory. Could not, in other words, if you write that someone was a mass murderer and say in the house where he killed all his victims, he also stole a vase, and that turned out to be false. The first part is true, the second part is false. He can't really sue for defamation, because even though it's false, it doesn't cause any greater harm to his reputation. His reputation is harmed by the fact he's a mass murderer, not by the fact that he's a petty shoplifter. So here, though, the court ruled that the statements in the advertisement were false and defamatory, but they added a new qualification. Because Sullivan was a public figure, the libel to be actionable also had to be published with actual malice. That's the phrase used. Not malice in the sense we understand it commonly as evil, but malice defined as knowledge it was false or with reckless disregard of whether it was false or not. Listen to Brennan, and when you hear what he writes and you're not taken aback by it and the implications of it, I'll be surprised. I quote from the decision. Authoritative interpretations of the First Amendment guarantees have consistently refused to recognize an exception for any test of truth, whether administered by judges, juries, or administrative officials, and especially one that puts the burden of proving truth on the speaker. The constitutional protection does not turn upon, this you quote from another case, the truth, popularity, or social utility of the ideas and beliefs which are offered. That erroneous statement is inevitable in free debate, and that it must be protected if the freedoms of expression are to have the breathing space that they need to survive. Listen to this. A rule compelling the critic of official conduct to guarantee the truth of all his factual assertions, and to do so on pain of libel judgments virtually unlimited in amount, leads to a comparable self-censorship. To put it into English, what are the implications of that last sentence? If you want to maintain, in fact, if the law would insist that any critic of an official in his official capacity has to guarantee the truth of everything he says as part of his criticism, people will be led to censor themselves, and that would undermine the First Amendment freedom of the press. But how could that be? Why would any individual necessarily be given a constitutional right to lie about others? Or, in a more pleasant context, why would the individual be given the right to make false statements without really investigating whether those statements are true or not? Now, the advertising department head in the Times testified that he had approved the advertisement for publication because he knew nothing to cause him to believe that anything in the ad was false, and because it bore the endorsement, meaning the signatories, of a number of people who were well known and whose reputation he had no reason to question. Neither he nor anyone else at the Times made an effort to confirm the accuracy of the advertisement, either by checking it against recent Times news stories related to some of the described events, or by any other means, even though, as the plaintiff asserted, the Times had evidence of the falsity of these assertions in its own news files, meaning they had covered the events in Montgomery in 1959-1960. They knew what was in the ad was false. I should say better, they would have known had they done the research. They did not do the research. Times have changed, you know, and most newspapers do now, I don't want to say meticulous fact-checking, but they do undergo basic fact-checks when they are printing an advertisement that makes assertions, or even, in fact, printing a letter to the editor. I remember years ago, a long time ago, it was the mid, maybe even the early 80s, I wrote a letter to the editor of New York Magazine, and among the things I blasted, my politics haven't changed that much in 30 years, but I said, you know, the Arabs and Israel are unhappy. Let them go live in any of the 23, Arab countries in the Middle East. Which I got a call from New York Magazine to say they can only count 21 Arab countries in the Middle East. And therefore, they had my permission to change the letter from the number from 23 to 21. Fine, go ahead. The court ruled unanimously that the plaintiff did not prove there was actual malice. That is to say, he did not prove that the Times published it knowing that it was false or recklessly disregarding whether it was false. Failure to retract was also not a sign of malice. And Brennan dismissed the idea that the word they always necessarily referred to Sullivan, which is probably the most reasonable part of the opinion. But primarily the court resolved, in essence, that one can lie about a public figure as long as it's not done recklessly or knowingly, which in any case is almost impossible to prove. As a special treat for this nice audience and the Mazinim as well, I'll bring you from our experience a very famous case where, in fact, we know this played a significant role. Think back to Ariel Sharon versus Time Magazine in 1985-1986. So, 1982, September 1982, after the Christians slaughtered, the Christian phalangists slaughtered hundreds of Muslims in Sabra and Shatila, the Arab refugee camps in Beirut, they blamed the Jews. Remember Begin's famous initial response, Goyim Gaharget Goyim, and they come to hang the Jews. Which is what happened. The main target, though, became Ariel Sharon, who was defense minister during the first Lebanon War. There's a Kahan commission that was established, Yitzhak Kahan, found that Sharon was, I quote, indirectly responsible for the massacre, just dogged him the rest of his days. That is to say, he should have known or should have prevented the massacre from taking place. Not that he knew, but that he should have known because Muslims have been massacring Christians already in Lebanon for 7 years, and therefore he should have anticipated that this was going to happen. Sharon was forced to resign, and he was, interestingly enough, barred from ever again serving as defense minister. He was not barred from serving as prime minister. Talk of short-sightedness. It wasn't even on the horizon. They figured that if a guy is forced to resign as defense minister, he'll never be in government again, much less become prime minister. All right, life is different. The very week the Kahan Commission report was released, Time published a story on the events, very critical of Sharon, but included these allegations. There was a secret appendix, an annex, to the Kahan report that was not released to the public. Time wrote as follows. Time has learned that it, the report, also contains further details about Sharon's visit to the Gemayel family on the day after Bashir Gemayel's assassination. You remember the context. Bashir Gemayel had been elected the president of Lebanon. President's always a Christian. Right after becoming president, strike that. He hadn't yet been inaugurated. But in the interim, he had entered into a peace treaty with the Israeli government. Before he was inaugurated, Bashir Gemayel was assassinated by Muslims. Probably by Syrians. I continue. So Sharon went to be Menachem Avil to the Gemayel family. Quote, Sharon reportedly told the Gemayels that the Israeli army would be moving into West Beirut and that he expected the Christian forces to go into Palestinian refugee camps, Now we come to the crux of the libel. Sharon also reportedly discussed with the Gemayels the need for the Falangists to take revenge for the assassination of Bashir, but the details of that conversation are not known. Alright? Nice cover. This, Sharon claimed, was false and defamatory. That in fact he went to visit the family. It was Amin Gemayel, Bashir's brother, was mourning with the rest of the family. He then became the president. But it never happened. No such discussions ever took place. And Time's source was an Israeli stringer, David Halevi. No impugning of Levi intended here. David Halevi hated Sharon, and he basically concocted this accusation. Sharon sued for $50 million, the case in the Southern District in New York, in Lower Manhattan. Time claimed first what they reported was true. The jury found it was false. Time claimed that even if false, it was not defamatory because Sharon's reputation was already in shambles. The jury found it was defamatory because there's a big difference between saying someone should have known about something than saying not only do they know about it, but they actively planned it. And very usually for a case like this, the sitting judge, Judge Abraham Sofer, let the jury announce each partial verdict as it reached its conclusions. Embarrassing for Time. Meaning, usually in a case like this, the jury gives one verdict. If it's false, defamatory, and with actual malice, then they vote that the defendant is liable. Here Sofer led them, asking a series of questions, and said, we don't have to reach the issue of malice or the issue of damages if you find that it's true. So he let the jury deliberate on each stage individually and reach its decision. First, it was false. Second, it was defamatory. The issue became one of malice, and on that count, the jury found Sharon was a public figure. Although Time acted, the jury actually wrote this in its decision, negligently and carelessly, it did not act out of malice, meaning with knowing or reckless disregard for the truth. Time announced it won the case. Sharon also announced that he won the case. He felt vindicated, but actual malice is a peculiarity of the American system. By the way, less well known, Sharon also sued Time in Israel when they maintain an office and business operations. And of course, in Israel, under Israel's libel law, there is no actual malice criterion, and Sharon won, and Time had to pay damages, although not that much money. It's a very strange standard, to say the least. And I can tell you, it's one from which I personally have suffered. I've lived it. twice in the last decade, newspapers have, I thought of suing newspapers that defame me, Jewish newspapers, attributing to me things I just never said or never did, and I learned to my chagrin two things. First, but they did routinely do not hear cases of Lashon Hara or Motzi Shem Ra, for the simple reason, as I was told, they'd be overwhelmed by it. Jews would be suing Jews every 2 days. And secondly, that I, for some reason, am to be construed as a public figure. And therefore, I would have to prove actual malice, which it's almost impossible to reach. So those suits went by the wayside. I never filed. And instead, I decided just to write publicly a lot so people know what I have to say without anyone putting any words in my mouth. It's a very strange standard, this actual malice standard. It's plausible in the light of the court's deference to the First Amendment and the freedom of the press. It's plausible. But is it moral? And ask a better question. What does the Torah have to say about all this? Well, obviously the premises are different and the conclusions are different. The Torah prohibits even truthful but hurtful statements, much more false and hurtful statements. So then how does the Torah conceive of a modern newspaper? Is such a thing even possible in the Torah's view of life? Very interestingly, there was a famous Rav, Reb Chaim Hirschenson, a great Gaon from Europe, came to America in the early part of the last century, became the Rav in Hoboken. Don't tell me you knew him personally. Okay. He wrote a very famous sefer called Malki Bakodesh, which is really one of the first svarim that dealt with the Torah foundation of a modern state. How a modern state would operate based on the standards of Torah. But he wrote a perush on the Gemara as well, in his Chidushim and Horios. This I found in a sefer, Mishtar u'Mendina b'Yisrael pi Torah. Now Hirschenson wrote, and here you see he's influenced by life in America as opposed to Europe, there's a value to a free press. The danger, he said, of an unfree press is always that the government will exercise too much power and stifle the people's spirit and lead them to excess. And he writes, just like Prohibition did, in the 20s, with Prohibition brought an increase in the alcoholism rate in America, not the decrease as one might have thought. Because once it became illegal, people felt a greater need to try to get alcohol and to drink more of it, lest the supply run out. So the fact it had... Don't tell me you drank during Prohibition as well. So it led to more. Because in theory, he says, the individual have to suffer so that society may benefit. And society benefits from a vibrant press that has very few limitations on its work. So that might make some sense in an American context. What do we say? We say the opposite. In Judaism, the individual's rights very often supersede the rights of the community. Every individual matters. For example, Rav Kook wrote, as you find in Alakri, the beginning of Pirkei Avos, Ein hayachid nitba b'yam haklal. The individual is not drowned, is not subsumed by the sea of the community. Each individual is unique. Olam malehu. So I'm necessarily going to say there's a value in society for which we have to sacrifice the individual. So too, Rav Soloveitchik wrote in Al Tshuva, Ein hayachid mitbatel keneged hatzibur. The yachid is, the individual is never nullified by the community. And the public's need to know, which is the most elusive and sometimes illusory term to begin with, is subservient to the individual's right to maintain his privacy and his dignity. Now this concept was applied even in an egregious case of not long ago. Rav Yitzchak Zilberstein, the dayan in Bnei Brak, was asked about the propriety of publicizing the name of a licentious woman with AIDS. Whether it's in Bnei Brak or elsewhere, I don't know. The woman in that part of Israel had AIDS, and she was going around with men, did not know her condition. They wanted to put her name in a paper, publicize it on the posts. I mean, there's another way to go about it, but nonetheless, That's what the Shiloh, can they publicize her name? And he said no. He said her rightful place is behind bars because she's a danger to society. But according to the Torah, it's forbidden to publicize her name. Why? In order to retain for her a petach l'tshuva, some opening to repent, and if her name is blared throughout the society, she'll just be lost, and not to besmirch the rest of her family by putting her name up there. We can agree or disagree, but you see, the mindset is different. It's fascinating, though, that the U.S. media, Dafka, would never publicize the name of such a person, because they fit into one of the protected classes. But we see, though, the primacy of maintaining the self-respect of every person. From another perspective, the Sullivan rule of actual malice fails the Mada'aloch Sani L'Chavrach L'Savid standard that we spoke of last week. Don't do something hateful to others that you wouldn't want done to yourself. Would you really want to be lied about? More, just embarrassed publicly to make a point? I thought of this, and right away triggered a memory that many of you might have of September 1988. David, I'm sure, remembers it very well. When George Bush, the first, was running for president, and he was interviewed in the CBS Evening News by Dan Rather, who was pestering him about Iran-Contra. Question after question. And Bush said, there's nothing else you want to talk about. He was persisting, asking questions about Iran-Contra. And Bush said to him, don't judge my whole career on that one incident. How would you like to be judged by the time you walked off the set, which was an infamous case from the early 80s, Dan Rather, was temperamental in any event, got annoyed that a tennis match ran over into the CBS Evening News. It was to start 7 minutes late, and he walked off the set. So when they shot to the news, nobody was there. He was gone because he got angry. They were waiting for it. So he said, how would you have your career be judged based on that? And Rather was very embarrassed by it. And I have no doubt that it impaired Rather's judgment so much that he foolishly went after Bush too in 2004 with forged documents and his own career self-destructed. But that's the background to it. Who wants to be judged based on a false accusation, even a true accusation, but one event? Who wants to be lied about? Who wants to be embarrassed publicly? Madaloch sani l'chavrach l'savin. In fact, under halacha, one is not even allowed to cause emotional pain or distress to another Jew. And Rabbi Rucham wrote in Das Chachma Musar, it's not the hapech hakamach, it's a separate mitzvah. You can't cause emotional distress to another person. And we're commanded on onas dvarim not to verbally wrong someone. Al tadnas chavercha shetagilim komo, don't judge another until you're in his place, which is nearly impossible. So it means don't judge another. And all this bespeaks the obligation to judge another person l'kaf schus and not l'kaf chova. To always try to justify their conduct unless and until it's completely unreasonable to do so. So this applies for the most part to the common sinners, to people who embarrass themselves, to people who are ignorant, and to people to whom one considers inferior. In fact, Rabbeinu Bach in the Chavos HaLevavos underscores this in the Shayichud Amas in the fifth parak. He says, don't let the Yetzara convince you, that you're unique and you have a special role to play in society, that it's your responsibility to point out the foibles, flaws, and misdeeds of others for the betterment of society. But Rabbi Wein would always say, don't think that you have to be God's Cossack. God is not a Cossack in the world. You don't have to be it. No one appoints any individual the authority to expose the failings of others. Unfortunately, that is an accurate description of what journalism is today. It's bad enough to tell the truth about someone, and Lashon Hara is the truth. So truth is no defense to Lashon Hara. But how do you defend falsehoods and lies? What are the laws of Lashon Hara, briefly? The Rambam says in Hilchos Deos, Perek Zayin, Halacha Gimel, Ezel Rachel, who's the Rachel, the peddler of Lashon Hara, Zesha Toin Dvar B'Holach Mizel, is a person who takes something, a set of ideas or a story, and goes from person to person, and says, Kach Amar Ploni, Kach Shomati, this is what I heard said,
This is what someone said, even though it's true, that destroys the world. And it's a greater sin than this, to speak disparagingly of another, even though it's true. Aval ha'omer sheker, nikra motzi shem al chavero. A person who speaks falsehoods about someone, that's even worse, we'll see. And the Ram continues in Halacha Hey, one who speaks Lashon Hara in front of his friend, not in front of his friend, or he says to someone something that indirectly will cause harm to another, begufo, to his body, mamono, his money, afila, hotzer lo, even just to torment him, lafchida, to intimidate him, hareze, Lashon Hara. That is Lashon Hara. If it's said before three people, karnishma hadavar. But of course, you can't be the one to bring it to the three. If you hear something in the company of three, so Ram says it's not Lashon Hara, if you tell it to another, as long as you don't mean to enlarge the number of people hearing it, which of course almost by definition you do. What about a Rasha? Is it permissible to speak Lashon Hara about a Rasha? The truth is that it is. It's permissible to speak Lashon Hara about an Apikaris, about a known in public Russia, about Bali Machlokas. They can be disparaged, they can be ridiculed, but even they can't be lied about. Again, in the Rambam, in Perek Vav, Hilchos Deos, Halacha Zayin, Haroa Chaver Shechata, O Shaholach Bederech Lotov, a person sees his friend sin, or go in a not good way, Mitzvah Zir Lemutov, he has to try to bring him back to the good, Ulodio, to inform him that he sinned against himself with these evil deeds, Hocheach Tochicha, Samisacha. And you have to rebuke him in any number of ways, whether it's a sin between man and God, whether between man and man, v'yadabelo v'nachas, lashon raka, speak to him gently, softly, and you should tell him that you're not saying this except for his own good, to bring him to chayolam above. If he accepts it, mutav. If not, you have to rebuke him again and again. Alright? If he doesn't, it's different. So the halacha ches, hamochiches chaver tchilo, lo yadabelo kashos, adshachli menu. You rebuke your friend first. You shouldn't speak harshly till he becomes embarrassed. Kachom rachachamim. You can't be mochiachim, and his face will turn white. Lo tisa lovchet. You can't embarrass any Jew, certainly not in public. And even though if you do, there's no malchus for it. Nonetheless, ein lo chelak olam haba. Lefichach sarach adam lizar shel levayish chaver beram ben katan ben gado. Person has to be careful not to humiliate his friend in public, whether young or old. Believer of a shem shu boshman can't call him by a nickname that he doesn't like. You can't speak anything in front of him that will embarrass him. Bamed var mum bedvarim shemen al mechavero. We're talking about things between man and man. But the Dirish Shemayim, Imlo Chazabo Beseser, if he doesn't repent in private, Machlimin Asobarabim. We do embarrass him publicly. Umefarsim Mcheto, we publicize his sin. Umecharfin Asobafana, we shame him to his face. Umevazin Umekalin Oso, we appreciate him, we curse him. Achi Yachso Lemutov. So there are cases we have historically from the Gemara and the time of the Rishonim, which men who didn't provide child support, or men who were adulterers, or men who didn't help their parents, or beat their wives, or were crooks or cheats, were publicly shamed according to the style of the times. Usually the Gabbai would get up, as it were, after Yishtabach and make such an announcement. Now we wait till after davening. But, or they would post a sign on the wall, so-and-so beats his wife and must stop, or so-and-so does not pay child support. All these fit in, and of course they'd be the same thing in newspaper. Do the same thing to get the word out. Like, for example, it's very, you see the many Jewish papers now carry the names of me'agnim, people who have rendered their wives agunos. We publicly shame them, so people should know about them. All these fit in the category of permissible Lashon Hara, but for that the Chafetz Chaim ascribes a number of rigid prerequisites. How do you know what to do? What is the trigger? Chafetz Chaim is very specific. The sin cannot be exaggerated. the person, the sinner, must first be approached privately. The intention can't be to harm him, but to protect society. There's no other way to effect that benefit to society. The motivation of the publicizer must be completely pure, l'shem shemayim, and the information must be verifiably accurate. In our case, the latter criterion is completely opposite. There's no justification at all for printing falsehoods. Thus, Rabbi Yonah writes in Shai Tshuva, in Shar Gimel, Siman Reish Chaf Aleph, Vida, ki bedvarim shebeirom l'chaveiro, sins between man and man, kemo, gazel, osheg, nezek, tsar, boshes, onas dvarim, theft, oppression, damages, emotional distress, verbal wronging, yochol esapa hadvarim l'tnei odom. You could tell, you can inform others. Even if a yochid sees this, he can tell others to protect la'asher ashamlo, protect the victim, as well as l'kanela emes, to be zealous for truth. Well, Gemara says in Yoma, daf peivav amar aleph, the Rambam quoted it, mifarsimen es achanofim, mitnechil l'ashem. We can publicize the names and deeds of hypocrites. Lest people learn from them, they'll think this person's a frum Jew. And he's doing these things, people learn from him and it'll cause a chil Hashem. Or the Gemara Moed Kondaf Yitzayim and Aleph speaks to the young rabbi, Surbamid Rabbanon, a teacher, Tahavusanu Shomaneh. He developed a bad reputation in the community. What was the reputation? So the Ritva says, Shayaporit Tsas Bezima, Velohoya Shmuaso Tova. Ritva says he had what we would call today as a woman problem. He was licentious. Teacher of Torah. Happens. Not anymore. Happened back then. Rav Yehuda put him in Cherem. Barred him from teaching. Publicized it. Because that's how you have to deal with it. And the Ramah writes in Choshen Mishpat, the beginning of Reish Chav Ches, Vish Omrim Dei Mitzuvin El Onas Dvorim Elul Yirei Hashem. He says, generally, we're only guilty of Onas Dvorim, verbally wronging someone, if the person is otherwise God-fearing. And the Ramah adds, Umishim me'anez atzmo mutu lahoneu. A person who wrongs himself, meaning he engages publicly in despicable conduct, we have not only the right, but the obligation to publicize him. These protections are ordinarily afforded only to Amisecha, Am she'itcha b'Torah uv'mitzvos, those who are with us in Torah. So in fact, there is a role for Torah-based journalism, even though I think that journalism as currently constituted is probably the most difficult profession for a Jew to engage in without blatantly violating the Torah. The most difficult. Remember, of course, that to expose the wrongdoing of another requires the lack of any ulterior motive on the part of the revealer. That's nearly impossible in this context. And again, all this applies only to telling the truth about someone. To write falsehoods is a grave crime. To commingle fact and fiction is a grave crime. This the Chafetz Chaim writes at the beginning of his work, Chafetz Chaim, on Lashon Hara. He says, anything that has ta'arovos shel sheker, mixtures of falsehood with truth, and because of the falsehoods, the person, the subject, is embarrassed even more. That's motzi shem ra. That's emitting a false name about someone. His sin, his iniquity, is even greater. You'll notice, you remember that Sullivan himself was never identified in the ad. His identity was only obliquely alluded to as Montgomery Police. Is there such a thing as Lashon Hara that does not identify the subject? The answer is yes. Part of that's Avak Lashon Hara, but the Chafetz Chaim is specific in Klal Gimel Sif Dalid. Even if the name of the offender is not mentioned, Raku Medabert Stam, the utterer says it generally, but in a way the listener can deduce who the person is. And in fact, if every Jew is not a public figure, that doesn't matter from our perspective. Every Jew is a creature of God. created Bitzelem Elokim with rights that flow specifically because of his connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So in summary, there is a place for journalism in the world of Torah. It's not the sensationalist, hypocritical, gotcha journalism of today where miscreants reveal the misdeeds of other miscreants. Journalists who are adulterers point out the adulteries of politicians. That's not the Torah's journalism. It's journalism that informs and enlightens and occasionally properly exposes the crimes of people who endanger the innocent. But today, especially in America, there's too much exercise of raw power and the need to sell papers is enormous. You know, you may have seen the news even from today that in Israel they're considering amendments to the libel law, which has the left up in arms. They want to raise the fine for defamation from 50,000 shkalim to 500,000 shkalim to ensure that the newspapers take much more care in what they print about people. But newspapers have a value. It's very interesting. Rav Bar Ilan wrote this in Mishtar U'Medina, Al Pi HaTorah. The great Baal Musa, the Alt of Kelm, Rav Simcha Zissel wrote in Chochmo Musa, Beis Kuf Tzadivov. He said, newspapers have a critical function in the world. Listen to what the Alt of Kelm said, of all people. He said, any person who lacks a desire to know the news is actually deficient. He has a chisaron. Because it means he has no feelings. Only a person who feels, a person who's sensitive, wants to know what's happening in the world. That's why God gave us Chochma and Bina, and a person who doesn't care, just shuts out the world of news, he says he's not even begeder Odom Klal L'Klal. We can't even consider him a human being because he's so unfeeling. But that's not the same as a voyeuristic right to know. And there's never an excuse or justification for lying about someone, whether it's reckless or intentional, for making the person's reputation worse than it is, for piling on, for commingling truths and falsehoods. So in that sense, the court's understanding of the First Amendment goes too far from a Torah perspective in safeguarding a public value of a free press by undermining the dignity of the individual. To us, what is sacred is the Tzelem Elokim. Rather, we maintain, as the Rambam wrote in the fifth parak of Hilchos Deos, Klolo Shel Davar, the basic principle is, Yehiye min hanirdofim velo min harofim. Better to be among the pursued than to be the pursuer. Min hanelovim velo min haolvim. Better to be one who's shamed and not the one who's shaming others. That is the Torah approach. I thank you all very much. So we don't meet next week, other engagements, but 2 weeks from tonight, we're going to take up the famous case, the infamous case, of Korematsu versus the United States, the case that dealt with the detention of Japanese Americans during World War II, and we'll discuss as well the Torah's treatment of enemy or putative enemy civilians in wartime. That's 2 weeks from tonight.